Well, still playing about, we looked round, and again we saw another remarkable thing. We found two small trolleys, about 10 foot by 10, with four wheels, where some of the linesmen used to sit on a little seat, two or three men, and coolies would run along the sleepers, pushing you. Well, we found these in a siding. Now, I'd hardly ever seen these before. I'd never seen two, but on this occasion we found two in a siding. We pulled it round, we tied it behind our motor car. We all got on with a great squeeze. The crucial moment had come. Could the motor car pull such a heavy load? I had grave doubts. However, we got in, the driver turned on the engine, let in the clutch, pushed his foot down the accelerator, and the motor car shot off down the railway line with our two trucks running behind us. The Chinese all shouting and screaming and shooting their guns into the air with great excitement. And we were thrilled. We were just like school children going off on a Sunday school treat. We almost were delirious. And we charged down this one-track railway, which had no side to, no tracks to pass other trains. We went rushing along. We came down a famous gorge, which later we were to blow up on the Chindit expedition, the mountain rising up on the left, a big river down on the right, and the train was not supposed to go more than 10 miles an hour, but we were so wildly excited we were crashing along at about 30 miles an hour with our two trucks behind us. We went right through tunnels, never knowing whether we weren't going to meet a train coming in the opposite direction, and then a terrible disaster. However, we drove on, and I now cheered our men up and said, "Now we're off to Michener, nearly 300 miles. But no, it was not to be. Again, we'd gone about 50 or 60 miles when we came to another small town, one of our other mission stations called Indore, which I knew very well. Just before we got there, we found six trains were blocking the line. It appeared that one of them had tried to go up a steep hill, and they had no coal, they were only using wood, and it couldn't take the incline, and too heavily laden, it ran backwards and had turned over. This had blocked the line, and five other trains coming up behind it all could not get past. Everybody who had been in the trains got out and fled through the jungle. So we could go no further. We were very bitterly disappointed. However, there was one advantage. We found plenty of food on the train, and we simply gorged ourselves with tin things. We also found clothes, and as I was expecting to live for about 6 months in Burma in the monsoons, in the villages, I told every man that he could take what he liked of food or any clothes, but he must take a gas cape, a Macintosh, and also a pullover, one of these big army ones, long sleeves, and thirdly, an extra pair of socks. I want you to notice that, an extra pair of socks. That was very important. Then we went on into Indore. There I met thousands of refugees, not English so much as Anglo-Indians, Indians, people who'd worked for Thomas Cook's and Banks for the English, who all felt that they were going to be captured by the Japs and were fleeing. And to my horror, I discovered the Japanese were only 12 miles away. I said, "What do you mean? How could they? We've come up the only railway line. There's no other road. The Japanese couldn't come this way." "Ah," they said, "while you were coming up the railway, the Japanese have come up along nice roads in the Shan States," that was more towards China, on the eastern side, "and they got right up north of us, and they were already now north of us, and commanding the railway, so that we couldn't have gone forward if we had. And so we had to change our plans and turn and go off to the left." Again, of course, the men grumbled and groused. And I said, "Why, you ought to be grateful to God, for in his mercy he's raised up these three remarkable miracles. First of all, the two motor cars, then the railway, and thirdly, the motor car that ran on the railway." And I said, "We're now at least 150 to 200 miles from the nearest Japanese, as I thought, but I now discovered they were only 12 miles away. They had come down the river, the Irrawaddy, to a place called Kathar, and there was a small road running from there, which was on our east, running straight in to where we were, and running further towards the river Chindwin. So we had to make a quick decision. We couldn't go north. I dropped all my idea of getting into our mission area, and we had to plan to go left. So our plans now changed completely. We trekked over the next few days, wandering on until we got to the River Chindwin. There we were bitterly disappointed to find a notice to say that there was no use going on over the mountains because the Nagas were very wild, and there was no food and no water, and we didn't think we could ever get over the mountains, which ran up to about 8,000 feet into India. And so it said the only thing for you to do is to go straight down the river to a place called Town Dut, 60 miles away. And they said, we are fording the river there, and we're going to mark, like scouts, a track all over the mountains for you to follow. Well, we felt we had to do this. This was the only thing we could possibly do. We followed down that way and trekked up over two ranges of mountains up to about, I think, about 8,000 or 9,000 feet high. The monsoons broke. We were soaked to the skin. We lay down on the top of the mountains. We got so stiff and so ill, we all got malaria and dysentery and other diseases. But in the amazing mercy of God, every single one of my party got safely through to India alive. We were then parted into different hospitals, and I lost touch with them. But God seemed to have fulfilled his promise in a wonderful way. And this was all the more wonderful when you think that from what records we've got now, they estimate that on that route I came out, probably 7,000 or 8,000 people died. Refugees, men, women, children, babies at breast, who had nobody anything, no food to eat, and people would lie down at night, and you get up and find 5 or 6 people dead. You couldn't bury them. Their bodies were putrefying, spreading disease. People were dragging themselves over to the river. Dead bodies were floating down the river, and we had to be drinking this. But in the mercy of God, he brought every one of us safely through to India. Just in case you ask one important question, what did we do for food and drink? Well, of course, up in the mountains, food, water was fairly all right, and especially as the monsoons came, and we tried to drink above the bridge, above the villages, where it was not contaminated. Food, we'd had some food in the train, but as we got nearer to the mountains, we were wondering what on earth we'd do. But in the mercy of God, a number of the tea planters in Assam, in India, had heard of our plight, and with the help of the American Air Force, they flew over us and dropped sacks of rice and some tins of cheese. Of course, these just dropped into the dry paddy fields. And we rushed madly up and started collecting all the things. But, to our horror, we suddenly realized we had no bags, nothing to put the rice in. What could we do? I had only just a small pocket in my shirt and my trousers. That would never do. It would fall out when we lay down. Somebody got a brilliant idea. Our socks, the clean ones, of course. And so we got our army socks out, and we pushed the rice into them. We tied them around the top, and we hung them down like two sausages or Christmas stockings on either side of our head. And that was practically the only food I had for the next about 3 weeks. I used to dole it out with 2 spoonfuls in the morning of rice and 2 spoonfuls at night. We managed to get some things to cook it, and so we trudged on, and we finally made our way into India. So I think this little story shows how wonderfully God looked after us. Of course, I'm not suggesting that being a Christian is a life insurance. One of my brothers, who was a very keen Christian, was killed at El Alamein, but I do believe that God gave us this wonderful promise and fulfilled it. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. Thank you. Today I want to tell you about my experiences on the Chindit expedition with General Wingate, when I was an airborne commando behind the Japanese lines for 5 to 6 months, doing guerrilla warfare as a chaplain. Now, this was in 1944, and is not to be mixed with another story that you may have heard me tell of how I escaped from the Japanese, which was 2 years previously, in 1942. We had retreated from Burma. Now the army was getting ready for the recapture of Burma. But before the army advanced, General Wingate went in to cut the lines of communication of the enemy. Perhaps you ask, how did I come to get on this expedition? Well, I believe it is because I was one of the few people who knew Burma. It was remarkable how few people knew the country or the language. I'd been a missionary there for 8 years. I could speak a measure in three different languages, and I knew the country. Also, I'd given a number of lectures to the Southern Army in South India on how I had escaped from the Japanese and lived in the jungle. And one of the officers told General Wingate about this, and so he sent me a personal invitation, who came down on a Dhamma, on a motorbike 400 miles, to give me a personal invitation to join the second Wingate expedition. Now, as many of you know, this was a very strenuous expedition, and so we had to have very strenuous training for it. In fact, in general, all the people on the expedition were supposed to be A1 fitness. They were supposed to be under 30 years of age. Unfortunately, I was 36 at that time, and I think I and the colonel were the two oldest men in the whole battalion. However, we went into training in central India. I had been with the 19th Indian Div before that, that later recaptured Mandalay, but I was now moved from there to the Wingate expedition, where we did very hush-hush training in the centre of India and later in the jungles of Assam. We had to be trained to march anything 25 miles to 30 miles a day, carrying a load of anything from 60 to 90 pounds on our backs. In fact, some of the men who had machine guns were carrying well over 100 pounds each man. Then, of course, we brought in a large number of mules with us to carry our transport and our heavier material. And there's only one snag about a mule. It's very useful for carrying your loads. But we were going to be guerrilla troops. And sometimes we'd be in a dense jungle and a small mountain track where the Japanese were going along, and we didn't want them to know we were there. And we might be some 300 or 400 of us. But, of course, you couldn't control a mule, even if you could control your men. And the terrible bit was that sometimes at the crucial moment, the mule would start neighing. And we had to stop them doing that. So we cut the vocal cord. I believe this was not cruel. And at the end of the expedition, any mules that were still alive, that had not died or been eaten by us in our times of great hunger, were getting back their voices and being able to work perfectly all right again. Then, of course, we all had to have beards. One, that we had to cut our quid to such a minimum that we were not going to be able to carry razors and extra things like shaving soap. And so we all were told to have beards. Apart from that, as Wingate pointed out, a man with a white face could be easily seen in the jungle. But if you got a big heavy beard on, it was a camouflage. And I think we all found that very useful. But it did mean that we all looked rather strange, and we hardly recognized each other at the end of the campaign when we shaved off our beards. We weren't quite sure who each of our best friends were. Now, of course, we had to do all sorts of training. I can't go into it all, but let me just give you an idea of one or two things that we did when we were in there, and we did training beforehand. Meals. We were on K rations, which was a small cardboard box about 6 or 7 inches long by 3 inches broad and 1 inch or 1.5 inches deep, and it would have some very compacted food inside it, a few biscuits, and it was the only thing was it was the same food every single day, and you got absolutely tired, sick of it. At the beginning it was all right, but later it almost came out of your nostrils. You got so fed up, because we otherwise had no meat, no vegetables, no bread, no rice, no anything for nearly 6 months. Again, of course, you could heat these things up and you wanted to make tea, but you would not be allowed to have a fire during the daytime, because that would give your position away. Remember, we were up in the mountains, and it's wonderful how far smoke or fire can be seen from miles and miles away out in the wild jungle. So we could never light a fire during the daytime. You got up early while it was black dark, and then just as the mist was rising, and there's always a mist rising from the wet jungle, we would light our fires, but we couldn't show any flames, must only have smoke which would mix up with the mist. And then again in the evening we did the same, again when the mist was rising. Of course, one of the frustrating parts, and yet a very important factor, was that after we'd had our meal, we were never allowed to stay for the night where we'd had the meal, in case the enemy had seen our fires and would creep up and in the middle of the night surround us and cut us to pieces. So it was very frustrating. You'd march 20 or 30 miles, you'd be dead beat, you lay down, you had your meal took out all your things out of your pack, and then when it got black dark, you had to put them all back again, and we'd move on 4 or 5 miles further. And sometimes, of course, it was very difficult to see all your things. We each had a tiny little torch with a tiny little range at the front, but you were not to use this unless you absolutely had to. But we'd move on. Well, then, often we had all sorts of formations in the jungle of where we'd deploy ourselves or sleep for the night. I'll just give you one idea. It was called what we called the clock formation. If you can picture a clock with the 12 o'clock, 3, 8, 6, 9 and all, we'd be going along these small jungle tracks up in the mountains, 3,000 or 4,000 feet high, and it was after we'd had our meal and it was black dark, and then you'd suddenly see the regimental sergeant major standing by a big tree almost on the path, and he'd point at the tree and say, "Pivot tree." Then he'd point straight up the track and say, 12 o'clock. Now that set your clock. That meant that in the opposite direction was 6 o'clock, on your extreme right was 3 o'clock, and extreme left was 9 o'clock. Now my position as chaplain was 7:30. So I'd walk up to the pivot tree, I'd turn left to face 9 o'clock, turn halfway towards 6 o'clock, and walk 150 or 200 yards down there, and then bed down. Of course, we had no tents, no shelters, no anything, and for 3.5 months it was pouring rain on us all the time. And of course, even before that, it was rather horrible. You'd get there, you couldn't put on a light, you didn't know what you were putting your ground sheet down, you'd feel on the ground to see there weren't too many roots or trees, and sometimes you'd touch an animal, might be a snake or something else, and it slithered away, and it was rather horrible to feel that you had to lie down on that spot, not knowing how far the animal had moved away. Well, now that was something of the training. I'm just giving it very shortly. Now we come to, secondly, to the fly-in. We were going to be flown in to Burma. You say, how did we go in? We were going in 250 miles over the top of mountains behind the enemy lines. How on earth was this to be done? Well, this was one of the wonders of the Wingate Chindit expedition. It had never been done before. Today, of course, we think of many cases of airborne commandos being landed behind enemy lines, but in those days it had never been done. Even the famous airborne landing of Arnhem happened after we were already behind the enemy lines for about 3 months, and even that was a failure. So it was very much an experiment, and many people felt it wouldn't work, which put a terrible strain on General Wingate, our leader. but his scheme was wonderful, and it worked magnificently. He had sent in planes for weeks beforehand to reconnoitre northern Burma. Now, of course, we must remember, northern Burma has very few roads and extremely few airstrips that were suitable places for it. So it wasn't as though the enemy could have aeroplanes very close, nor could they rush their troops to us as quickly as they might have liked. And we made good use of this. But in order to bamboozle them still more, Wingate, for the week or more, 10 days before we flew in, every single night, he flew in American Air Force under Colonel Cochrane, and it was claimed that they had destroyed 50 Japanese planes on the ground before ever we flew in, which, as far as I can see, as we had complete superiority, air superiority at that time, the Japanese were tremendously jittery, and when we finally did fly in our planes to land behind their lines, they probably thought we were bombers and were thanking God we weren't bombing them. But instead of that, we weren't. What were we to do? There were no airfields to land on. So Wingate had chosen 5 different spots, a distance of 30 or 40 miles from each other, where there were open paddy fields surrounded by mountains that wouldn't be seen. Now, in the dry season, of course, the paddy fields are all flat. But there's a snag. In the rice fields, there are what we call the buns, a little way for the farmer or paddy person to walk along to keep out of the water. They'd be about a foot or foot and a half above the rest. So it meant in every 100 yards square or 200 yards square, you'd have this little wall of mud. And of course, if a plane came in and hit that, it would go over and we'd all been killed. So he had to get rid of this. How was he to do that? He therefore decided that the first night they'd fly in aeroplanes with gliders in tow. The aeroplanes would not land, but the gliders would have to crash land on the paddy fields. And they brought in bulldozers, which they got out, and they flattened out the whole rice field for nearly 1,000 yards, and then we flew in the next night and landed on the improvised Vericacha airfield. Well, now, it was a terrible strain, as you can imagine, whether it was going to work successfully. And they got assembled all in for the first lot to go in Assam. Field Marshal Slim came down to watch it, and he and some of the others were rather critical. And about 10 minutes before the whole thing, the first gliders were to go off, the first disaster happened. Some recce planes came in to say they'd photographed the air, the place they were going to land, and they found logs of wood had been pulled right across the paddy fields. Of course, people all thought that the news had leaked out, though we'd tried to keep it private, and that the Japanese knew what we were doing and had put these to destroy our planes. General Wingate went absolutely mad, and absolutely in a terrible state, because all his plans seemed ruined. However, to make it worse, they had to change their plans completely, and he had to decide at the last minute, as Piccadilly, as we called it, was blocked, to fly Brigadier Calvert in to another airstrip place called Broadway. But even there, we hadn't reconnoitred that so carefully, and so it was very risky. He gave orders that they were to fly in. If the thing was a success and we were all to follow, they were to send a message by radio called pork sausage. Pork sausage. Rather nice sausages. If things were a failure and we couldn't fly other in, we were to send soya link sausages, which were the sausages we did not like. Calvert took off, and there were a number of disasters. They were trying to pull too heavy a load. A number of the gliders broke off because they had to go so high up. They hadn't anticipated it was going to be so difficult. And some crashed in the jungle. Others got through, but of course the gliders landing, there were a number more casualties. Still, it wasn't so bad. There were only about 30 to 40 people killed. But the whole strip that they'd got was covered with broken gliders, and it looked as though we couldn't land anybody else. And so Calvert sent the awful message, "Saw your link," which meant failure. "Don't come." This terribly upset Wingate. He thought all his plans were upset, and he couldn't sleep a wink. But at 7 o'clock the next morning, another message came through, "Pork sausage," which meant, "We've cleared the ground. Come in." And within a week, Wingate had flown in over 7,000 men, 1,200 mules, stores, and even light planes and anti-aircraft guns. It certainly was an amazing feat that had never been done before. I went in a little bit later to another strip, and there again, the aeroplanes we threw in were just DC-3s. We had no protection whatsoever to our planes, no guns on board, and because there was such a shortage of parachutes, nobody had a parachute. So that if any single enemy plane had spotted us, come up and attacked us, they were flying at twice as fast as us, they had guns, we'd have been a sitting target, and there would have been absolutely no hope for us. And yet the incredible part was that not one single plane was destroyed. Every man, after that initial disaster, got through safely. And finally we worked up to nearly 20,000 people landed on 5 different centres round northern Burma without a single casualty except for the first day. This indeed was an amazing feat. And now let's go on a stage further and come to, well, what did we accomplish? Here again, it's difficult to say at all, but I'm going to just summarise one or two things. Of course, our main job as airborne commandos or guerrilla troops were to cut the lines of communication of the enemy. Now, the enemy at the time were mainly in the north, because the Americans had been very keen to open up a way between India, across the top of Burma, into China, because Roosevelt was most anxious to aid the millions and millions of Chinese we had there, and he felt if he could harness them to our expedition, we could overthrow the Japs, because so many of our troops were still needed in North Africa and in France. He therefore sent in General Stilwell with some specially trained divisions of Chinese and American troops. And the Japanese, of course, rushed their troops up to cut these people. We were to fly in and cut the lines of communication of the Japanese so they couldn't send any reinforcements up or any ammunition or any stores. And bear in mind, there was only one railway running up to northern Burma and no very proper roads, just a few roads the jeeps could go on, but nothing very adequate. So if we could cut those few roads and keep them cut, the enemy couldn't reinforce, the Japanese couldn't reinforce their men up there. Now that was one of our big jobs. I'll give you an example or two of what we had to do. My own battalion was given orders at the very last moment to blow up the Bon Chaung Gorge. And the colonel, knowing that I was one of the only people who knew Burma, came to me and said, "It's highly secret, Padre, nobody else knows our destination, but as you know North of Burma, we are to go to blow up the Bon Chaung Gorge. Do you have you any idea where that is? Have you been there?" I said, "Well, remarkably, sir. When I escaped from the Japanese, I went through the Bon Chaung Gorge. That was the area that I went in when I was in the motor car with the two little trucks behind it, one of the miracles God raised up in that escape from the Japs. We went down the Bon Chaung Gorge. It had got a high mountain behind us on the one side, dropping down to a river on the other, and going through tunnels. Well, now, that was the objective we had. We were to blow up one or two bridges and bring the cliff down, so that it would take a very long time to repair that, and the whole railway line would be disrupted for months, and as far as we all saw afterwards, for probably nearly a year. That was our destination. Now, to do that, we'd been landed about 50 or more miles away. We were told we must under no circumstance let any Japanese see us getting to the railway, because that was the danger spot. So we'd got to get over there without being seen. Woe betide us if we were seen. So we had to keep right up on the top of the mountains. We had to be very careful. Nobody ever met us, Burmese, to report where we were or who we were. And we came by a devious route so that to make them think we were going another way, and got at long last to the railway. We were now on the top of the hill in the bushes, and of course the jungle of Burma is so dense that you often can't see 20 yards away. We got our battalion there, but then now we had to get our explosives, which we couldn't carry at the time. So we had to have an airdrop, special airdrop by parachute. And we couldn't bring that too close to where we were, or it would have given away the whole show. So our muleteers had to go back about 15 or 20 miles and wait for the airdrop, hope the Japs hadn't seen it, and bring the explosives. We were therefore left for about two very awkward days. On the top of this hill, the railway line down below, we could hear the trains going through, and we were to keep as quiet as could be.